So this retreat, we're going to be on holiday of Chandrasi, a bit of compassion. What you may find going on in your mind, though, in many of the meditation sessions, is not thoughts of Chandrasi, not thoughts of compassion, but thoughts of what in our samsaric minds is the most important thing.
Me.
Not you, me. Okay. And you'll see all the distractions are twittering around me. Okay. The people I like. Okay. It seems like we're concerned with others, but it's always because they do something nice for us. So we're distracted by the people that we like, by the people that we don't like, by what we want, by what we don't want, by all of our ideas about how things should be done, which is clearly my way, isn't it? All these ideas that are so... they all come back to the self. Okay, how I want things to be, the way they should be. Okay. And we don't, in our ordinary life, see these things as all revolving around the self. Okay. Instead, we see everything we think as reality. Okay. We don't think of our ideas as ideas, we think of them as reality. So whatever I think is true, otherwise why think it? Well, let me tell you, once you start practicing Dharma, you realize most of what you think is not true. Okay. And that's one of the things we're going to be examining during this retreat. You know, how much we believe in that isn't true, that we clutch on, cling to as true, and how that causes us suffering. Okay, and like I was saying in the motivation, one of the primary things we cling to as true, as real, as the center of existence, is this one here, me. Okay? So we all come to Cloud Mountain and we're all thinking, oh, I had such a hard week. We don't think, oh, the other 42 people here had such a hard week. Didn't, maybe you came into the meditation hall thinking that? Yeah? Most of us came in thinking, oh, I had such a hard week. Or, I came to this retreat to really relax and learn something. But in a very comfortable way, please don't push me. We woke up this morning. Who did we think about? First thought this morning. Yeah. Ourselves. Or maybe we miss somebody who is important to us. So we wake up missing so-and-so because they're not here. But we miss them because they're important to us. Okay. So we see that our whole life is just so preoccupied with me, I, my, and mine. Okay. All the time, again, 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 again. Okay. And yet, who is this self that we are so sure exists? What is it? And we say, it's me! Okay, who? Who's that me? Where's that me? Well, it's here. Or maybe you say it's here. Where do you say you are? Where do you think you are? Are you somewhere behind your eyes? Yeah? Or are you somewhere inside your ears? Where are you? Yeah? Are you in your little toe? Are you inside here? you slice open and go like that, then the little figure pops out going, hi, here I am. Where are you? Where are you? Or what are we? We say, I'm a woman, I'm a man, I'm Swiss, I'm American, I'm Egyptian, I'm a computer consultant, I'm a salesperson. We have all these identities for the I, don't we? Are you those identities? Now, are you your gender? Yes! Women's rights! I mean, that's how we feel. So, you know, who exactly is the center of the universe that we take so much for granted? Yeah. Where are you going to find it? What is it? You know, we can't say there's no person, that there's no self, because we're all sitting here. Okay? But the thing is, do we exist in the way we think we do? Is the self what we think the self is? Okay? Or is the self existing in another way, not how it appears to us? Okay? So that's kind of our question here. And similar with the things that we're attached to. Yeah. I want my chocolate cake. Everybody, we all have our own version of chocolate cake. Okay? Your piece of chocolate cake might be your boyfriend or girlfriend or husband or wife. Okay? Your piece of chocolate cake might be a stack of money. It might be a diploma. It might be a certificate on the door, or a title on the door. You know, there's, I use the expression chocolate cake, Lama Yeshi, he thought it was incredible how we all love chocolate. So he always used the example of chocolate, so I guess I'm in my teacher's tradition. I hope in more ways than that. But anyway, you know, we all have our own version of chocolate cake, our non-negotiable, what we have to have, what we can't live without. And how do we view that thing or person or situation that we can't live without, that we have to have? You know? It's so solid and real too, isn't it? And it's always just a little bit out of our grasp. You ever notice that? Always just a little bit, we're close but not close enough. So we see all those things around us as equally solid, and then of course, you know, try so hard to get them or to push them away depending upon our mood. And through that we create a lot of actions or karma. The karma ripens, you know, it influences what situations we find ourselves in. And, you know, then we're in different situations going, why me? Why is this happening to me? As if either there were some other being manipulating us, or everything was completely random and chaotic. No. We don't think of ourselves as having created the cause to be in the situations we're in. We usually see it as the situations we're in as somebody else's doing. God blessed us, or God is punishing us. Or it was meant to happen. What does that mean? You know, we always say that. Oh, it was meant to happen. What's that mean? Meant by who? Does somebody have a plan? Are we just acting out the roles of somebody else's plan, so it was meant to happen because somebody else wrote the script that way? Is that what our life is? Okay, so all these things are things that we really need to consider and to think deeply about, because our views on them really influence how we live our life. And how we live our life is how we practice the Dharma. So in this vacation that we're on with Chenrezig for the next week, what we're trying to do is see things a little bit more clearly and identify what our wrong views are and let them go, cultivate some correct views and live from their perspective. So instantly the first question we have is, oh, that sounds very good, but how come we do that by imagining this figure that has 11 heads and 1,000 arms, you know, and is made out of radiant white light, you know, and has a green face and a red face, and, you know, huh? You're telling us we're going to come to reality by thinking about this? This sounds much more unreal than anything else I've ever heard of. Yeah. And then I'm saying all these prayers about, you know, Mount Meru and, you know, all these goddesses in the sky and, you know, wish-fulfilling cows and wish-fulfilling gems and unplowed harvests, and this is going to get me to enlightenment? Come on. Okay. So, we have to understand a few things here. First of all, in the case of the mandala offering, all the imagery in it is according to ancient Indian culture and their view of the world. Okay, so they saw the world as a flat with a center mountain and all these things around it. The whole idea when we're doing that practice is, you know, we don't have to go back to thinking that the world's flat. But the idea of doing the practice is we're offering the universe and everything beautiful in it. I think in modern terms, you know, instead of saying here's the goddess of light, the goddess of beauty, the goddess of song, the goddess of dance, you might be saying, you know, here is Macy's, here is, you know, Hewlett-Packard, here is Enron. Really? I want Enron in my mandala? You know, here is, what's the one that makes all the sports equipment?
Nike.
Nike, okay. Here's this, you know, and so that's in our universe. You know, here's a television set, here's an LCD projector, here's a, you know. I don't know. I don't get too jazzed about having all those things. It just seems like a bunch of clutter to me. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, in our mandala, that's maybe what it is. Here's a BMW. Here's a Jaguar. Here's a Porsche. Here's a Rolls. Here's an electric car, you know, or a hybrid car. You don't want to pollute your mandala. But the idea is that we are offering the universe and everything beautiful in it. Okay, that's the whole idea behind that. So don't get too hung up on the imagery. If you want to put, you know, Macy's and Saks Fifth Avenue and Walmart and Kmart, yeah, and Safeway in your mandala, that's okay. You have to imagine them glittering and beautiful and actually with the ability to bring happiness. Okay. Then why are we imagining this deity with, you know, 11 heads and 1,000 arms and you know, what that's going to bring us to an understanding of reality. Well, we have to understand what chenrezig is, okay? Don't latch on to chenrezig as that physical appearance, but rather think of the qualities of wisdom, okay? The wisdom that knows things as they are, not this wisdom that is reifying and fantasizing and, you know, creating objects of attachment and objects of anger, but instead the wisdom that knows things as they are. So think of that wisdom, and then think of the quality of compassion. Okay? Not icky, gooey, condescending compassion, but very straightforward compassion that actually cares and is willing to do what is ever necessary for the benefit of others, whether we like those people or don't like them or even don't know them. Okay? And so think of those two qualities of wisdom and compassion appearing in a physical form. Okay. In the same way that an artist or a musician may have certain feelings or certain qualities that they want to express by means of sound, so they write music, or by means of art, so they create a statue or paint something. Okay. Here we're taking those qualities of wisdom and compassion and expressing them in a physical form, okay, giving them a shape and a color and a way to relate to them, because we are beings who are quite attached to form. Okay. It's a way, it's a symbol, just as words are symbols, aren't they? They symbolize different things. Yeah. Sound symbolizes also. Visual things symbolize. Okay. So chenrezig is symbolic. Okay, so 11 heads. Those of you who are mothers know the advantage of having 11 heads. Okay? Because when you have kids, what do you need? You got to look in all directions all the time to take care of your child, because you never know what they're getting into. Well, similarly, chenrezig is like a mother in that respect, looking out for all sentient beings, okay? Being aware of where we're at, what we need, and how it can manifest in order to guide us on the path. So looking out at all the sentient beings, the 11 heads. Parents also know how handy having 1,000 arms would be. Okay? Because you have to drive the car with one, hold your cell phone with the other, take care of the kid that's crying in the back seat with the third, and then your other toddler who just got out of their car seat with the fourth. And then, you know, you need really several more hands because you're hungry, so you need to get that. Actually, one hand for the baby isn't going to do. You need a few hands, and same for the toddler. And if you have more than two kids, then you really need a bunch of hands. Yeah. For a teenager, I don't know what you need. You know, how many hands you need. Or maybe your hands are all sitting there bringing each other by that age. Okay? But, you know, we can see that having 1,000 arms to reach out and care for beings, you know, we can see some symbolic sense in that. Okay? Having that extended hand. Not a closed fist. Chenrezig's hands aren't like this. Yeah. This is mine. You're 18. Spend for yourself. Okay? It's not like that. Chenrezig's hand is open. Okay? Chenrezig's arms are like this. You know, most of them anyway. Yeah. How do we usually sit? Like this. Don't we? Yeah. What does this tell you? How do you feel when you sit like this? Protected, aren't we? We're protecting ourselves. Or sometimes I've noticed the guys stand like this. They put their legs a little bit apart and their arms across their chest. They talk to each other like this. Yeah, we say a lot through body language, don't we? Yeah? So it expresses what we're feeling inside. Tendency isn't like this. Tendency's not like this. Tendency's like that. How off, how comfortable do we feel like this? Put your hands up. How comfortable do you feel like this? Yeah. In one way, it feels like such a relief, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In another way, do you feel a little bit like, you want to go like this? Better like this? Yeah. Yeah. And have your hands open. They're open. Okay? And then close your hands. Feel what that feels like. What does it feel like to have a tight fist? Okay, open your hands. Yeah. And think that you're reaching out your hands to other living beings. Okay. So you're reaching out your hand to somebody you really care for. That's easy. Okay. Maybe you're reaching your hand out to cut some kid in Somalia who's hungry. That's okay. Reach your hand out to somebody you don't like. Okay? Reach your hand out to your most unfavorite politician. Yeah? That suffering sentient being. Reach your hand out. It's really something, isn't it? Yeah. So we might periodically do that through this retreat. Yeah, just practice sitting like that and see what effect it has on us. Because it's much easier to have an open heart, isn't it, when you're like this than when you're like this. Yeah. So we see through the way Chinmesi's standing, you know, his whole body posture, it's expressing some kind of inner quality. So when we're meditating and imagining, you know, a deity that looks like this, we're trying to get in touch with these inner qualities through this kind of symbolic form. Okay, Chinmesi's first two hands are at his heart. Like this. Okay. What does this gesture mean to you? Okay. What else?
Reverence.
Yeah. What else? Wishing. Okay. Aspiring. Do you ever use it to show respect? So it has a lot of different meanings. We're sometimes very hesitant to put our hands like this. There's one monastery where I go to visit sometimes, where I have some friends, and they all greet each other like this. Every time you see somebody, your hands are together. It's incredible what it does to your mind. Yeah? When every time you see somebody, you greet them like this. Really changes something in your mind, because it's really a way of honoring or showing respect or expressing reverence, yeah, expressing some kind of appreciation for other beings' existence. Such an important gesture. So Chinmesi's first two hands are like that. Also, Chinmesi's thumbs are tucked in like that, so like holding a jewel. So especially, you know, if we're thinking of the Buddha Dharma Sangha, we don't want to come empty-handed. Yeah, we come with a jewel. We're offering that jewel. What is that jewel? It's our own Buddha nature. Okay. So we have some sense of our own Buddha nature. We're not coming empty-handed.
Wow.
We're not going in front of Chandrasi, gimme, gimme, gimme. Bakshish, bakshish. Mensa, bakshish. You know, we don't go in front of Chandrasi like that. That was, I think, only something that people who've been to India might understand. In India, what the beggars do is they'll have their hands out. Bakshish means kind of like, give me a present. It's also what you do when there's officials that you need something from. It's also called bribing. I mean, it has many words. But, you know, we often go in front of others like this, don't we? Gimme, gimme, gimme. And so here we're going in front of Chinesi, you know, with reverence, or you can see his posture, one with reverence, remembering the Buddha nature, the emptiness of all phenomena, okay, showing respect. So here's Chinesi, a fully enlightened being, with his hands still together like this. Incredible, isn't it? Yeah. How are we when we're high up on the status ladder? Are we like this, showing respect to the people who are beneath us? How are we when we're high up on the status ladder? Nose is up there in the air somehow. Here I am. There's a certain kind of strut, a certain kind of walk that you have when you're high up in the status ladder. I was noticing that yesterday when I was in the airport. There was some guy, I can't tell the different uniforms from the different branches of the military, but some military person. There's a certain strut, you know, certain way of walking. Yeah. So, but Chenrezig is being quite humble. Yeah, fully realized being quite humble. Good example for us, huh? Okay. So you see through all these things about Chenrezig, he's expressing the inner qualities. Okay. He's holding a rosary, you know, with his right hand, saying the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, and then his other hand is, you know, reached out and the nectar is flowing from it. And then this one has a dharma veil, huh? Yeah, turning the dharma. And then the lotus. And then the base with nectar, you know, pouring out the soothing wisdom nectar for all the beings. And then the bow and arrow, okay, which symbolizes realizing emptiness, because your arrow is your wisdom that's going right to the target. Okay. So all these things are symbolic. The body made of light. So nothing... no concrete body. We feel our body in a very concrete way, don't we? Yeah. Here's my body. It's solid. Chenrezig's body is a body of light. Imagine if your body were a body of light. Yeah. Do you still have arthritis? Do you still have thyroid problems? Do you have to go on dialysis? Do you have cancer? AIDS? Does the body of life have any of that? Okay. Do you have headaches? You have a body of light. What happened to your migraines? It's interesting, you know? Think about it. And so we have this conceptualization of this very concrete body. And I think just by thinking of our body as so solid that adds to the feeling of discomfort in the body. Mm-hmm. And our body is uncomfortable, isn't it? So Chenrezig's body is a body made of light. doesn't need to worry about getting in a car accident because there's nothing to get squished. Okay? You have a body of light, nothing gets squished in the car accident. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's teaching us through the symbolism. So very, very helpful. You might notice that Chen Rezi is not holding a mirror looking at himself. And doesn't have, you know, a comb and a brush. Bottle of hair dye, mascara, you know, a razor, aftershave, you know. Chen Rezi's not holding all those things. Chen Rezi's okay with how he looks. His identity doesn't depend on how he looks. Think about that one. How much does our identity depend upon how we look? How much do we rely on how we look to present ourselves to other people? How much do we judge other people by how they look? It's a very interesting thing, you know, just to get an idea of how biased our mind is and how our mind projects concrete entities onto other people. Think of somebody that you know and imagine them in a different body. Think of their mind and put them in a different body. Okay? Think of your mother. Okay? Now, put her in the body of a 25-year-old man. Okay? Or think of, you know, some 25-year-old man, you know, and put him in the body of a middle-aged woman. Yeah. We judge people a lot based on their body, don't we? We really think they are their body. Yeah. It's funny when we do that. And so, you know, we worry about how we look because we expect other people to judge us based on our body. And we create an identity for ourselves based on our body. And then we judge other people based on their body and create an identity for them based on their body. But are we our bodies? Imagine George Bush as a baby. Can you think of him as a baby? Think of one of your grandparents. Remember that they used to be a teenager. Or think of a teenager and think that one day, you know, if they live that long, they'll be 70 or 80 years old. Or think of somebody you know and think that they might become a fly. Or they might become a god in the celestial realm. It's interesting, you know, when we think like this, it feels funny to us, doesn't it? Because we're so sure that people are who we think they are right now. In the same way that we're sure that we are who we think we are right now. You know? We think we are the person that we present ourselves to others to be. Well, actually, we don't think we're like that. We're trying to convince other people we're like that, because if we do, then maybe we can convince ourselves. Isn't it? You know? We're sitting here, we feel so insecure. You know, incredibly insecure. Don't we feel insecure? Don't you feel insecure? Hello out there? Yeah? I mean, let's admit it. Yeah, we all feel insecure, don't we? It's nothing new. Okay, so we're sitting here, you know, we're all insecure. How do we present ourselves to the world?
Do it this way.
You know, because we're thinking that if we present ourselves as like completely self-assured, then other people will think we are, and then we'll think we are. Okay. On the other hand, we also think, oh, I'm so insecure. Oh, I'm so insecure. Oh. We create an identity out of that too, don't we? Yeah? We're not just conventionally insecure, we are inherently insecure. And so we sit there and kind of whimper, you know? Yeah. Is that who we are? Is that who you are? No, we're not that either, are we? Sometimes we try and present that, but, you know, sometimes we get tired of doing this one. Yeah. So then with the people we feel really close to, then we're this one. I'm insecure. Yeah. So we grasp onto all these things as our identity, don't we? We're so busy trying to make identities. Yeah, either to ourselves or to somebody else, or to project something, or to deny something. Yeah. This is all just hallucination. Yeah. It's just all hallucination. Because who is it that's insecure? Yeah. Who is it that's self-assured? Who are you? Okay. So these are the kinds of things we're going to be thinking about, yeah, during the retreat. But Sannyasi's form expresses those.